Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. And today in the show,
we think that the electoral power of Indigenous people has been understated, and our argument essentially is that there is potential Indigenous electoral power to be activated.
A new analysis shows First Nations votes matter more than we think. We found out more. Also, why the next government needs to address the current environmental laws. And later today,
cold union, talk to cold union. First point of call, first point of conversation, besides your caseworker, would be another cold woman in the community.
A new group of culturally and linguistically diverse women will be responding to domestic violence within their communities. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, after a heated debate last night, the New South Wales Lower House passed the Voluntary Assisted Dying Bill, introduced by Independent MP Alex Greenwich. All state MPs received a conscious vote on the matter. The bill will make New South Wales the last state in Australia to legalise voluntary assisted dying, but now the issue needs to go federally. I started asking Vice President of Dying with Dignity New South Wales, Shane Hickson, her thoughts on this bill passed.
Oh, look, we're very relieved. This has been a very long campaign. Dying with Dignity has been advocating for this law reform for nearly 50 years. On a personal level, I've been campaigning for the last 10 years after watching my mum suffer terribly at the end of an aggressive brain cancer. This will provide such comfort to people who face a terminal diagnosis. They will know that after the 18-month implementation, if they get to the end of their illness and their suffering becomes intolerable, that they will have a legal option to get medical assistance after a very highly safeguarded process, but it will enable them to have the peace of mind that they will not be forced to endure prolonged and unbearable suffering.
Now, how did Dying with Dignity New South Wales see all the process of legalising voluntary assisted dying in New South Wales? How long and complex was this process?
Well, in the first bill for New South Wales was first presented in 2002, so that's 20 years ago. I saw a bill fail in 2013 and another bill fail by just one vote in 2017. But fortunately, since 2017, every other Australian state has debated their laws and passed their laws. So Victoria has had their law operating for nearly 3 years, Western Australia for nearly a year, and Tasmania, South Australia and Queensland will all have their laws come into effect either later this year or early next year. New South Wales residents, unfortunately, will have to wait a little bit longer, but we're just so relieved to have reached this point where, as I said, terminally ill people will have that palliative effect of knowing that they can control the end if their suffering becomes unbearable. We have had thousands of supporters support this most recent campaign. We were able to present a parliamentary petition, last over 100,000 signatures. So we're reflecting the majority support that's been in the community for decades. And so it's a huge and historic day.
Now, one of the main people involved in this was Independent MP Alex Greenwich, and he mentioned that Compassion has won in New South Wales, but other MPs said the opposite. Why was it important to pass this bill in New South Wales at this point?
Well, we're catching up, obviously, with the other states, but I certainly support Alex Greenwich's comments. This is about compassion, and it is hard to understand the opposition's perspective because we have always supported palliative care, and the truth is the majority of people will die well, supported by good quality palliative care. But there are some people whose illness creates symptoms that cannot be relieved, even with the very best of palliative care, and that's why we do believe that it is a compassionate thing to be allow someone to determine when their suffering becomes too much. And as long as they pass all the eligibility criteria, they have decision-making capacity, they're an adult, then who, you know, to have other people impose their religious beliefs, because at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's people, strong religious beliefs, who feel that this can never be an option. But this is voluntary, so no one who feels strongly against it would ever need to worry that they're going to request it. They don't. They can stay completely outside the scheme.
Now, New South Wales was the last state to legalize voluntary assisted dying, so all states so far are in that path. What's next on the agenda, do you think?
Well, Dying with Dignity over the next 18 months will provide sort of information, hopefully have play some role in the implementation if we're needed. And then once the law has been implemented, again, just providing support and information if people don't know how to access the scheme. We also are concerned about all end-of-life situations, so we support people generally with understanding advanced healthcare directives, because this law, as I said, is very narrow. So there's still work to be done in other areas, making sure that people have appointed an enduring guardian.
The Northern Territory and the ACT work under a different legislation under the federal law. Would it be fair to say that the next government needs to see this as a priority as well?
Absolutely. We hope that whoever forms government after this weekend's election puts as a priority the overturning of what was referred to as the Andrews Bill, which came into effect over 20 years ago and overturned the Northern Territory's voluntary assisted dying law, which was in fact the very first law of its kind in the world.
That was Vice President of Dying with Dignity New South Wales, Shane Hickson. A new analysis from the Australian National University shows First Nations votes matter, and not just in regional Australia. The analysis found out several marginal seats have more Indigenous eligible voters than the electoral margin at the last election. While it's only viewed First Nation votes are decisive only in the Northern Territory seat of Lingiari, the analysis shows Indigenous vote is becoming more prominent. I asked Research Fellow at the Centre for Aboriginal Economic Policy Research at the Australian National University, Francis Markham, what motivated him to analyse the topic.
With my colleague, Byamir Williamson, who's also a researcher here at the ANU, we were really interested in this question about Indigenous electoral power, because we often hear this frequently repeated line that because Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are only 3% of the Australian population, that essentially Indigenous people don't have much power to influence politics at the ballot box. And we're really interested in kind of unpicking this a little bit. So you might sometimes hear that in the division of Lingiari, which is a marginal seat in the Northern Territory that covers essentially the whole of the territory apart from Darwin, and Indigenous voters are about 45% of the electorate there. And Indigenous issues often get a strong run at elections in Lingiari. But often that's all you hear about Indigenous voters in federal elections in Australia. So we're really interested in saying, well, where do Indigenous voters have influence in Australian elections beyond Lingiari? Are there other places where their votes really matter or could really matter?
So besides the NT with its two seats, you mentioned Lingiari and Solomon, what other marginal seats do you think Indigenous votes can make a difference?
So it's quite interesting when you look at the relationship between where Indigenous people live and marginal seats. And there's really sort of two very different types of seats that come out of this analysis. Some of them are like Lingiari, and so they're remote seats with a relatively high proportion of the population who are Indigenous. So the most prominent of these is probably Leichhardt, which covers far north Queensland and the Torres Strait. And there, the margin of votes between the two major parties at the last election was around 5,000 votes. And there's around 20,000 Indigenous people who are eligible to vote in that electorate. And so somewhere like Leichhardt, Indigenous voters are likely to play a very large role in determining who is the winner in that seat, which is also quite a closely contested seat.
One of the issues you found in your analysis with Miami as well is the low rates of Indigenous voters in the electoral roll. Could you please expand a little bit on the issue?
So this is really a really long-running issue in Australia. Indigenous people were only enfranchised in Australia in the 1960s, and in remote parts of the country, voting for Indigenous people was only compulsory in 1984. And we still see relatively low rates of enrolment and turnout today. There's questions about the extent to which this is people feeling like their vote doesn't matter, so why bother? And there's also real questions about the administration of elections and the electoral roll in many parts of Australia. The Australian Electoral Commission is currently the subject of a complaint of essentially racial discrimination in terms of how it administers enrolment and voting in some parts of remote Australia. And so these things combine to mean that Indigenous voters, to the extent that we've got statistics on this, probably only half of eligible Indigenous voters are both enrolled and turn up to vote on election day.
You also mentioned in the article that enrolling First Nations people to vote is not enough to advance Indigenous interests, which completely makes sense to me. What other tasks do you think is needed to give an electoral empowerment to First Nations peoples?
So I guess what we were trying to say in that article is that, you know, we think that the electoral power of Indigenous people has been understated and that people have been very pessimistic about this. And our argument essentially is that there is potential Indigenous electoral power to be activated if people could get organised and if some of the barriers to participation were brought down. But we're not arguing that this is going to be a silver bullet for improved Indigenous public policy or representation. There'll still be many other avenues that need to be pursued to make change.
That was research fellow at the Centre for Aboriginal Economic Policy Research at the Australian National University, Francis Markham. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan in Brisbane. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM, to our friends in Kirby Bay, Queensland on Fraser Coast FM, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. With the upcoming federal election, many issues are top of mind for voters, with a major one being the environment. An independent review of Australia's key environment laws was conducted by Professor Graham Samuel in 2020 and listed 38 recommendations to fix the environmental laws. The Wire's Georgie Bolles asked Professor in Sustainability and Urban Planning from RMIT Sarah Beckesy which recommendation has the government implemented so far.
Graham Samuel's review was that we really need a holistic kind of reset for our Threatened Species Act and the way that it's, you know, implemented and regulated. And unfortunately, one of the recommendations was that they could think about how the Act is enforced and whether the states could play a bigger role in that. And so the only thing that the federal government has implemented from this review is actually devolving powers to the states, which, you know, in some respects is an abdication of their responsibility to their own acts and is definitely cherry-picking, certainly not tackling the major differences and major problems with the way that the Act is regulated and enforced.
The Morrison government released in the budget earlier this year they are planning on reducing climate change funding from $2 billion to $1.3 billion by 2025. What are the environmental implications if the coalition remains in government?
Well, look, the science is pretty clear that if everyone in the world followed the same intentions as the coalition government, we'd be seeing a temperature rise between 3 to 4 degrees. And that doesn't sound like much, but it's essentially, you know, the end of the world as we know it. You know, it's catastrophic for our natural systems. It will be really, it'll make a lot of places uninhabitable. It'll obviously lead to sea level rises. The reef will be functionally extinct. It's not a future that any of us want.
Labor has promised to provide a full government response to the Samuel Review. Will this be enough to protect Australia's biodiversity and threatened species?
We actually know exactly what's required to save any further extinctions from happening. And really, in summary, it's clear less and invest more. And one of Samuel Graham and Samuel's review points, recommendations, was that we need to have an independent watchdog to make sure that the intent of the Act is actually followed and upheld. So that will go some way to addressing that issue. And then the other thing is invest more. We need to solve some really big problems like feral cats and foxes that continue to threaten a lot of our small marsupials and mammals. And we've actually estimated, we've predicted and quantified exactly how much it would cost if we wanted to avoid any further extinctions. It's about $1.7 billion per year, which may sound like a lot, but, you know, we spend $21 billion per year on our pets. So, you know, it's a small fraction of that, and it would stop further extinctions of our native, you know, incredible native plants and animals.
Australia has experienced major natural disasters in recent years, with bushfires at the end of 2019 and the recent floods in Queensland and northern New South Wales. Why is there not a larger emphasis on taking action on the root cause of climate change from either ALP or LNP?
Climate change is repeatedly rated as a top concern. I think there was a survey out a couple of days ago that showed that 90% of Australians are worried about climate change. There's very rarely consensus on issues in Australia, and that to me is, you know, pretty widespread consensus. I feel like they're worried about the transition that's going to be required to move to a emissions-free kind of future, which is really what's required. But, you know, it's already happening, isn't it? Look around you. There are solar panels on everyone's roofs, you know, and industry is even without kind of the incentives from government, is moving towards, you know, carbon neutral future. So it is definitely the way of the future. The whole world is moving that direction. It is absolutely gobsmacking and why we don't have a major party stepping up to say that we need action on this and showing some leadership. I get the feeling it could be a really popular move if someone was prepared to do it. I mean, certainly the Greens have stood up and actually made some pretty solid commitments. The kind of commitments that we need to hold climate change at 1.5 degrees, which is still going to be not nice, but at least it won't lead to, you know, the catastrophic demise of our ecosystem.
Yeah, as you're saying, the Greens have committed $24.4 billion to environmental restoration over the next decade. Is this enough to protect Australia's biodiversity and threatened species?
It's definitely aligned with what the experts are saying we need in terms of investment. And as I said, it sounds like a lot of money, but actually, you know, we spend $21 billion per year on our pets, which is per year. The Greens commitment is over a decade. So, you know, it's quite a small sum of money, really, when you think of it, what it would achieve in terms of saving our critically endangered species, our koalas, our reef, our gangang cockatoos, our, you know, amazing bogong moths, all these things that Australians care about. But we're just seeing such pitiful investment and attention given to them by recent governments.
That was Professor in Sustainability and Urban Planning from RMIT, Sarah Bekesi. Ending the report from The Wires, Georgie Ballas.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire. Daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Throughout 2021, Settlement Services International provided training for culturally and linguistically diverse women to become social respondents on delicate issues such as family and domestic violence. The program called Supporting You and supported by the New South Wales government was done from Cal Women to Cal Women, and this week the organization showed the outcomes of the program. I started asking Acting Head of Women, Equity and Domestic and Family Violence at Settlement Services International, Julianne Nkrumah, what Supporting You was about.
The Supporting You program has been running since basically about February 2021. The funding was secured in December 2020. And the purpose of this program is to engage women leaders in communities to provide access, accredited training on GV for them, and to embed their knowledge and skills through regular, structured, and facilitated learning circles. So this is knowledge and skills around domestic and family violence, basically how to spot red flags, understanding and nuancing coercive control, understanding what options to give women and where to refer women to. So very important. So through the training and learning circles, we were able to grow the confidence of the women we engaged to help other women in their communities who have facing domestic and family violence.
Okay, excellent. So coming to the event last night, how was the environment at the program launching?
So basically the event last night was to launch the vignettes that were created as a result of the wisdom that was shared during the learning circles. So we asked the minister to launch it. The environment was amazing. Everybody is reporting on such an amazing event that we did last night. It was successful. It brought together project participants, government officers, community service and settlement service providers, and of course, SSI staff. The women participants who I'm responsible for were very excited to meet the minister and to meet the CEO of SSI. And some of them were so excited that we did this at the Parliament House in New South Wales. Some actually were visually overcome and said, we've never been to the Parliament House. So they were very, very happy. It was such a fulfilling event.
Juliana, what motivated Settlement Services International to implement this program?
You know that Settlement Services International is a social business and also a settlement agency and a consortium lead for over 20 settlement services, including migrant resource centers. So we are at the cutting edge, at the front face of new arriving refugees and migrants to Australia. When people arrive in Australia and find that Australia has a position on domestic and family violence, it's really encouraging for them to be able to voice what is happening to them. And what they do is when they're experiencing domestic violence, they tell their case officers, case managers. Our case managers are not domestic violence trained managers. And yet they were receiving a lot of disclosure from women. That's on one side. On the other side, the statistics show that 8 in 10 women will disclose domestic violence or report domestic violence to family, to friends, and to women and religious leaders in communities. So these women are there, they are receiving the disclosures, but they don't have, and if at all, they have very, very limited knowledge of domestic violence and very limited knowledge of the referral points. So if they are going to help, they're only going to be using traditional knowledge. And if you watch our vignette, you realize some of the women saying, oh, they tell me to go back to my family, to my marriage, and take responsibility, not to provoke him, to be kind to him, to be nice to him. That doesn't solve domestic violence. But this is all that the women have as bystanders. So by training them in domestic violence and doing the learning circles, we provide knowledge and skills that gives them confidence to help women.
The interesting thing about this program is that it was done for CALG women to support CALG women. So why is it important that culturally and linguistically diverse women support CALG women in difficult issues such as domestic and family violence?
Absolutely. CALG women talk to CALG women. First point of call, first point of conversation besides your caseworker, who is also a CALG person, would be another CALG woman in the community. But the most important issue is that CALG women know. They know the culture. They understand the culture. So they come to domestic violence from the cultural angle, and they are able to nuance the disclosures through the cultural lenses, and they have the language.
That was Acting Head of Women, Equity and Domestic and Family Violence at Settlement Services International, Juliana Nkrumah. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you're in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you would like to listen to any of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional owners of the Turrbal and Jagera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Eduardo Jordan. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.